Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
It is my great pleasure to welcome this evening the Reverend Professor June Boyce Tillman, who is a Professor Emerita of Applied Music of the University of Winchester and Extraordinary Professor of the Northwest University of South Africa. And her topic is embodying musicking. But before we start, let me give you just a few bullet points about this wonderful lady we have the honor of hosting tonight. I think, June, and correct me, but from what I've read, there are two life forces running through you. One is music and one is theology or spirituality. You're an educator, composer, a researcher, and a performer. I believe your special interest is, or area of expertise, is Hildegard of Bingen. And you perform her as well as research into her. You've written widely on the role of women in church music and music as a tool for reconciliation. And I was particularly interested to read about the Space for Peace events you hold at Winchester Cathedral. So all of this sounds just really like you would be just the kind of person I would like to spend an evening with. And I'm curious about what embodying musicking means. I've had to look the word musicking up. I have to admit I'm not a native speaker, but I'm sure you'll explain it to all of us. Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to be here, and I feel very privileged to be able to speak with you. And I'm going to start really with linking with the Forest Without Borders, because in my hand here is my trusty drum, which comes straight from a forest. The person who made it would have asked the tree permission to give its wood. On the top, we have a goat skin, which the goat no longer needed. And here we have fibers holding it together. And when it's in the right place, and it can't be in the right place to show you, I'm embracing it. In a sense, the drum is perhaps the most intimate relationship or any musical instrument that we have with the natural world, other than consuming it as food. I can do no more than this collection of the forest will do for me, and it can do no more than I will ask it to do. So it's a very, very, very intimate relationship between the forest and me. And somehow along the way, and this is what I'm going to look at, we've lost thinking about the relationship between the natural world and music. And I'm going to show you one other instrument before. This is my latest one. The sound of it is this. This is basically a branch of birch, a beech, and it's a beech. You can see the markings, there you are, the markings of the wood. and this is left very close to looking like a branch. And when I play it, I hope I'm playing the tune that the beech tree is asking me to play. And we're going to come back to that as well. And we could change ecological understanding at a stroke. If when we taught the violin, we taught every child to open the case and say thank you to the wood that gave itself in order to make the violin. I wonder how many times we pick up a musical instrument and we remember where it came from. Even our computerized instruments, our digital technology, has bits of sand from the beach vibrating inside of it. So that intimate relationship between my body and the natural world is a very important part of what I'm going to share with you. I'm going to go into share screen now so that you can see some of the images that I'm going to show you. I'm going to start by telling you about where I started, because that drum and that relationship to the drum would have been where I was when I was a child and where many children are, grubbling around in the garden or in the forest in order to play with what sounds the stones can make and so on. Unfortunately, we often teach that out of people. So there's my plan. It's much too long, but I shall shorten it so that you will have time for questions. But I started, as Doris has in fact explained to you, by singing in church. I just stood and I sang. I didn't read the words, I couldn't read the music, but I joined in like that. I also made music for trees. My first song was about a silver birch tree, and I still love it a lot. I sang songs to my cats, who replied in their own singing voices, and I loved birdsong. I was a brownie, and I sat around a campfire, again with no music, no written music at all, and I enjoyed singing in the same way as we see there, repetitive songs. I became aware that not only am I in relationship with my body, but I'm also in relationship with the space in which I was singing. Singing in the forest was very different from singing in a church like you see on that slide, or singing as I mostly did in the village hall. Or indeed, the sort of lesson you see in the middle where I will be singing around a piano as we did every Saturday night with my grandparents. And since singing is so good a thing, I wish all men, sorry about the non-inclusive language, but this is from the 16th century, wish all men, the exercise of singing is delightful to nature, good to preserve the health of human beings. It doth strengthen all the parts of the breath and open the pipes. So the notion that singing is deeply embodied. And one of the great losses in our culture is that many people today don't sing, and I'll look at why that might be. The idea that a singer was someone exclusive was not there. Everybody sang. Some sang well, some didn't, but singing was as normal as breathing. We sang up the woods, we sang anywhere. We sang when you felt in the mood, you'd be in the pub and someone would start a song, and all of a sudden the whole place lit up. I sang in school, that's a sort of village school where I was educated, but my curriculum in those days was not reading, writing and arithmetic, but reading, writing and rorting. For those people who are not English speakers, rorting is making things with your hands or dancing and all those things. So there was more or less a third of the curriculum was embodied, and that we have lost in education now. We tend to learn about music, but perhaps not actually perform it in any way. We tend to learn about textile studies, but we don't hold a needle and sew. I did dancing. It was mostly folk dancing in those days, and dancing was very important. I even danced for the coronation of the Queen up in, with lots and lots of children wearing red, white, and blue, and so on. And singing was often taught here with hand signs. So somehow or other, the sounds were related to signs in the body in some way. And I sang folk songs, learning them by ear, but they had already been written down, and we'll come back to that. There are some of the songs that I sang. So my early days were singing songs with my body, being aware that I was short of breath from time to time, that higher notes required more effort than some of the lower ones, and so on. When I was 7, I learned the piano. And here I started to encounter the literate Western tradition, what is often called the Western classical canon, and great composers. And I had to learn to read the dots. I started to study piano, and I went through the piano exams of the Royal Schools of Music, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4. Most of that was, could I decode the 5 lines and dots successfully? Sometimes I did get through those to playing with real expression and real feeling, but a lot of those exams are, did you play that G and was it a crotchet of the right length? I learned also about listening to music. Although in my primary school I had danced to music, now I learned about sitting and contemplating music, disinterested contemplation coming from philosophers like Kant, cultivating a taste, a particular state of mind. I learned that I could appreciate music in this way. And I learned about a classical concert, where, as you can see, it's actually very difficult to move anything except your big toe because you're imprisoned in a number of seats and so on. But actually, if you do look at the average audience, you will find just a little bit of the body. But that notion that what you do with classical music is sit and listen to it in some sort of contemplation of some kind was what I learned. And what I did in class. Pieces were played on a record and we sat and listened to them. So movement one, what was I learning? I was learning about cultural power. I was learning the Eurocentric system of A. I learned about ad activity leading to products. I had to produce a good performance to get my exam. I learned to be outside the music in some way, to understand it. And so on. But I didn't learn a lot about being in music, which I had been as a child, about personal feeling. There's a lovely story of a piano teacher who charged one rate for teaching the notes and the other for putting the feeling in. So you could play the notes without any feeling. And that value system underpins the literate Western classical tradition. It was the regime of truth that I was put into, the politics of truth, to look at as Foucault saw it. It was the one that distinguished true from false, what was valued and what was not. I was told really that folk music was not as valuable as the classical songs of Purcell and so on. And that what I'd done as a child was childish. It was not an adult person would learn to read and so on. So I was learning what counts as true. And many of you will know that Nietzsche used Apollo and Dionysus to describe European culture. I was learned to be Apollo, the god of reason, control, and so on. And to actually be very suspicious of Dionysus with the freedom and so on and so forth. But maybe we need to integrate the two together. Maybe they belong together, and that's what I'm going to share with you. Here are the value systems that I've set up in one of the books that I've written. On the right, we have all the things that I was taught to value: the individual, the public, the product, the disembodied, the rational, the challenging, the unity, and the excitement. I'll give you an example. I couldn't carry on playing the pieces that I liked playing because I always had to learn one that was just a bit too difficult so that I would progress. I couldn't just play for the fun of playing. And the story, of course, many of you will know, the writers of music history have been mostly male, and the writers of words have included a higher proportion of women than people realize. But the history of art in general has been dominated by men. Women's traditions have traditionally been been much more embodied, particularly things like the lullaby and things like the work songs that you see there, women singing while they were working in some way or other. So that's the invention of the literate tradition meant that often women were excluded, partly because they didn't have access to things like opera houses and things and orchestras. And many people felt very sad because they were subjugated knowers. This is lovely from a Korean theologian. Han, I love her description, is the suppressed, amassed, and condensed experience of oppression caused by mischief or misfortune so that it forms a kind of lump in one's spirit. So I think many women and many of the races that we dominated in our imperial capacity felt subjugation. What they would do naturally was subjugated by the incoming European tradition. And still I listen to classic FM in England and it says the world's best music. There's still that notion that that classical stuff is God-given in some way, but that is actually a cultural construct. The worth and status of all improvised informal amateur music can be eroded in subtle ways with terms like high or low culture, amateur or professional, national or local, and so on. So the construction of knowledge in the West was power and white. Knowledge gave you power and made you raised you up in some way. And the curriculum in our schools fed discrimination, hegemony, privileged colonialism, promoting the dominant view of knowledge. And there we have the same thing. This is Walter Ong, who says that the imperial project in his beautiful book, Orality and Literacy, The Technologizing of the Word, says that the imperial project, apart from just taking people's land, was actually a triumph of literacy over orate traditions. Everywhere the Europeans went, they found orate traditions, traditions passed on by word of mouth, which has to be embodied. And they said, you must learn to read. That was true of text, but it's also true of music. I'm a professor in South Africa, and I see the effects of that there. And critical race theory is beginning to see how race explained the oppressive structures that we took out into the colonial sphere. And you asked me, Doris, at the beginning, this is Christopher Small's term, to music is to take part in any capacity in a musical performance, whether by performing, listening, rehearsing, or practicing, by providing material for performance or by dancing, it is descriptive, not prescriptive. It takes place in a physical and social setting. And we can ask the wider and more interesting question, what's really going on? So when Christopher Small wrote about musicking, he meant the totality of a musical experience, not just the dots on the page or the people performing, but everybody who was there, dancing, singing, round the edge, and so on. It was an encounter, a set of relationships, and that was very clear in the orate cultures that, that we met when the Europeans went into places like the African continent. And what faces, I think, education today, and indeed radio stations and streaming and all of that, we may have to make painful decisions about the values that we hold. Which of the values that formerly served society well can continue to be maintained? Which of the treasured values must be jettisoned and replaced? I'm suggesting that we need to see those two systems as equally valuable. We need to imagine a global community with wider forms of political associations, different types of community, but we're in a piecemeal, disjointed and largely unplanned. We've seen this in the COVID crisis, where we see people now singing from their balconies, where we see professional musicians turning their hand to trying to encourage community musicians. So oracy and literacy, orality and literacy. We see the little girl there learning the violin with her music, and we see the boys there, and we sing the logo of the organization I run called Music, Spirituality and Wellbeing International, restoring orality alongside literacy. Because the way that traditions that are written down function are different from the ways that traditions that are not written down. The orate tradition has no way of passing things on other than from one person to the next. And so folk traditions do that. And what is passed on is a guideline or reminder, not a set of precise instructions, a river rather than a road. There isn't any way of saying if I sing a folk song differently, that's equally right. Whereas if I sing a different note from what Schubert wrote, then it's wrong. So you have that much more fluid relationship with the past. Most folk musicians understand the term process, where our artifacts are continually changed, minutely or in significant amounts, and so on. So the continual embodiment in the body of performers causes that change. Many of the African cultures that colonials encountered were orate cultures, which were initially at least devalued in favor of Western classical notated traditions as the Western value systems gained prominence. And in Africa, I still find it in South Africa, people who think don't value the drumming and dancing and harp tradition there, they value them as less than reading dots. In America, we see what happened when the literacy of the Europeans met the oracy of the orality of the slaves. And there we see some of the hymns now being not requiring books, but the lines being repeated so that it was easier to learn. And so they were just making it up. The word composing isn't in the orate language. I'm not going to do this in any detail, but because those of you who heard Olu Taiwo earlier on will know that time operates differently in those orate traditions. You tend to be going round in a rather fluid way, whereas when you're reading an orchestral score or a vocal score, you're going along and you're concentrating on the past and the future. Whereas in the orate traditions, you're concentrating on the present. And we see the difference in the dance traditions in terms of embodiment. We see European ballet taking off from the earth, aspiring to the sky and reason. Whereas in West Africa, we see the traditions going down into the earth. I'm going to go more quickly through these, except that it stopped moving forward for some reason. I'm afraid I've lost the ability to move it forward. So the notion, I'm going to go on and hope that I can regain that. So you have a much more flexible tradition when we have an orate tradition rather than a written tradition. I think I may have to do the rest of it orally.
June,
in England. Sorry.
Would you like me to share screen and you say if I continue or you prefer to say it orally?
We'll see if I can get back into it. Have you got the PowerPoint at that point now where I am, Francisca?
I am going to go over there.
If you can go to the one that says community music in the UK.
All right.
In England, what we see is a rebellion against the literate traditions and the rise of the community choir, singing not from dots, but singing by passing on an orate tradition. We see a new way of discourse. And now, can I control this, Francisca, or not?
No, I'm afraid
right.
No.
That is the Yoruba drumming tradition, and we'll skip over that one. That's one of the orate traditions. There's the community music. And we see balance in the keep going, in the 21st century attempts were to restore the imbalance. And there we see a way of expanding the discourse, involving new skills and expanding the concepts, and through performance, communities finding new ways of seeking truth, and so on. So on we go. And so the stress on literacy initiated the process of demusicalization for many people. So if we go on through, next one. And we have now around in the UK, two aesthetics of singing, and I think across the world. The classical perspective emphasizing performance, perfection, and virtuosity, which has been the aesthetic recognized in music education and in the wider world since the 1800s. And if we move on, we see the result of that. King's College Cambridge has done for church music what Barbie has done for women. So King's College Cambridge, with that style of singing, which was very selective, selected only people who could make a certain sound, excluded women, required you to be able to read the dots, was part of that aesthetic. And many people think that they can't do singing because of that. But now we see a new aesthetic, stressing community building, diversity, and group collaboration and relationship. On we go. So the community choir, many of them now coming, the Can't Sing Choir, Singing for the Terrified, the Natural Voice Network, on we go. On we go. Can we go on? And we see choirs for well-being, recovery choirs from addiction, threshold choirs singing around the beds of the dying, choirs for the homeless, and the AIM choir for women who have been trafficked and have now been released from the trafficking. So we see the contrast in these choirs. Are you going to go for accuracy and or uplift? On we go. So we see a move towards music and health and a development of how music affects the brain and the breathing and the mental relationships, the health. On we go. There's a lot of work in this area. You'll see the brain scans here of all the bits of the brain that music triggers, which are considerable. On we go. So the benefits of singing, social, lifestyle, functional, breathing, breath control, and so on. And plenty, lots and lots and lots of literature in that area now. On we go. And there's the Singing for Wellbeing Choir in Winchester. We can flick through these quickly, Francisca. We have people singing. You see the movement incorporated into it, people with dementia. On we go. We see the collaboration and communication for people who have not been able to communicate often in many other ways. On we go. So music is healing, as John Taverner writes. In embracing the written dots, sometimes we've lost the original intention of music, according to the ancients. All of them is to give hearts ease. And I think that is the one thing. If I'm able to give 1 inch of heart's ease, that would make my life, my work worth doing and living. And we've rediscovered that notion of music and healing. On we go. So this is a wonderful statement from a classical singer, in fact. In Space for Peace, which Doris has mentioned, one thing they have to do is to walk along singing peace on a single note carrying a candle. And this was a singer who was a very good literate singer. I have sung for many years, she says, but it always meant working out if the next note was G sharp or G natural and a crotchet or a quaver. Because you only asked me to sing a single note, I was aware of the breath entering and leaving my body. It was a meditative experience. So she'd lost that sense of the breath coming in and out because of the literate tradition. On we go. And this is what I just want to hold that. And you've all got your, I think your microphones muted. So what I want you to do is to look at that, which is the chakra model of the body. And I want you to start at the bottom with an ooh sound. So can you make that sound? Ooh, right at the bottom. And then I want you to do a scream. I'll just do it once for you. So let's have all of you screaming. Nobody will hear you except the people in your house. You can tell them it's part of the presentation. Ready? And can you, when you do that, hear the sound moving up through those points in the body from the bottom, the low chakra, right up to the top chakra? And the vowels do that. And E appears to come out of the top of your head, whereas O appears to come out down around your feet somewhere. So a scream a day keeps the doctor away. It's not by accident that the first thing the baby does is scream, because after all that long journey down through that tunnel, you need to purify yourself. So, and that's why the fair is so popular. It legitimizes screaming and everybody feels released by that scream. On we go. Can we go on with it? We are developing things like sound baths now, where other people are making the sounds for us around us, and sounding bowls and gongs, and do look on the internet for sound baths. A whole body refreshed by sound coming in. On we go. And sounds, the rediscovery of sacred words, which often use all the vowels, like alleluia. Alleluia. Can you hear how some of those holy words actually take the sounds through the body? And shalom is wonderful. You get the shh of white noise. And then down to the So those holy words are not words for meaning, they're words for sound that are holy and sacred because of the sound in them. On we go. So finding your note is another little exercise for you. I'm going to sing four notes and I'm going to see you see if you can sing them and see which one was easiest. Okay, so here's number one. La. So see if you can sing that one. And what did it feel like? La. No, go back, that's it. Now try this one. La. Do it on R because it's easiest. La. What did that one feel like? Now try this one. It's number three. And then the last one. Now you've had four notes, one in the middle, one low, one up in the middle and one high. Ask yourself which of those notes was the easiest for you. If it was note three or four, I suspect you became a singer because that was the pitch that schools used for pitching the songs. If your chosen note was number two, you probably were cast as a non-singer fairly early in your life because it was a low note, and low notes in general weren't in the singing pattern for children. You might have got in if note one was the best for you. But each of us has our own note, the note that is easiest for us to sing at any given time. It's getting late in England now, so the lower notes are easier for me. In the middle of the day, the higher notes would have been easier. But everything you sing relates to that, your own note. So if you have been disempowered from singing, demusicalized, then find the note that you want to sing. It could actually be quite low, especially if you're a man or an older woman. La, la. Older women post the menopause have a much lower compass than they had earlier on. They acquire what I call the wisdom notes. If you feel that you can't sing, when you go to have your shower, find that note and sing along with that note and get used to it. Because if you don't sing that note, there'll be one note missing from the universe. Because only you have that structure of your larynx, your mouth, your lungs, your chest, and all of those things are in the sound that you make. Don't worry about making a pure choir boy sound. If it's a that's many of the jazz singers have loved that sort of sound. Enjoy the quality of the sound. Fall in love with your voice again, because you have a voice, and if you don't use it, then there'll be one voice missing from the universe of sound. On we go. So, and then we have other, these are other thymatics, if you're interested in the effect of sound on the body, that's another area as well. On we go. We've had various explorations of how to embody sound by movement. We saw the folk dancers of my school, but those of you who are interested in anthroposophy coming through Rudolf Steiner and that, you have this wonderful eurythmy, which was designed to basically express the inner movement of the music. And it's very beautiful to see and watch. It's done in schools as a therapy, but also done as professional performances, as you see above. So on we go. And this is another form of eurythmy, and that's concentrating on melody and rhythm in particular ways. And eurythmy is very well worth looking and very popular in Germany, I see Michael saying, and so on. And to be distinguished from Dahlgren's eurythmics, which are different from the Steiner strand. On we go. And now we have another development where another person, and I would recommend you to look at Richard Schusterman, is developing soma aesthetics and trying to reinstate the embodiment of music. You see there next door, one of the Hildegard images of the human being embodying all the features of the natural world. And it's all of that that we use when we make music, and we have sometimes forgotten that. And so Richard Schusterman has been looking at the use of the living body as a site of sensory appreciation and creative self-stylization. To move on, next one. And based on John Dewey and his notion of music, of experience as a transactional, as an interface between us and the environment. Again, I go back to me as a child singing with the birds and so on. On we go. Next one. And there we have the senses can be improved through heightened awareness of what we're doing when we're making music, improved and also of our feelings. So our body and our feelings need to be aware of them as we're musicking. And we don't need to drive the body in the way that some really harsh classical traditions have, and often wrecked bits of the body, like the vocal cords, by asking too much of them, being aware of what's going on. On we go. And there's the soma aesthetics, and on we go. And some of the musical traditions, the instrumental traditions, have been aware of movement. And those of you who know the drumming traditions, but this one is about the Kodo tradition from Japan. As I strike the drum in front of me, a wine barrel with two ends, she's describing that as an experience of soma aesthetics. We'll see it if you go on to the next slide. And there's the Kodo drumming. You see the man, the actual movement. So playing the Kodo drums is a mixture of movement and music and sound making. So the two are joined together in a practice. On we go. And there we have, let's skip over that one. On we go. Now this is the model that I've created. Can we just go back a slide? That's it. that in music we encounter the materials of sound, our bodies and the natural world. We encounter the meaningful world within ourselves and others. We put it together in patterns of some way, and we've already seen that the patterns of orate traditions are rather different from the patterns of literate ones. And we encounter value systems like community or perfection. On we go. So there we are, we encounter, and we'll go on to the next slide now. So we encounter the materials, and if we go on to the next one, and there you have what I was saying to you earlier. There are 1,000 ways of singing, from the very pure sounds to all these variety of sounds. So make whichever sound you like. If you haven't been able to sing, don't judge the use whatever tone color that you want to use. On we go. The acoustic space is very important. When I do something in Winchester Cathedral, I go down into the cathedral beforehand and I hold on to the stones and I say to them, I've done everything that with the human bodies that I can. Now the rest of it is up to you, because it's the stones that will take the sound and throw it around in their own way. And that's true of any acoustic space. On we go. The natural world providing it, but there is a movement now called eco-musicology, which is saying that the way we've made instruments has actually been environmentally destructive. Here's one of the examples. The bow of the violin with its arching is made from the Pernambuco tree from South America. And the Pernambuco tree is dying out. So we need to look again at how we've ravaged the natural world to make our musical instruments. And we haven't actually asked for permission like the maker of the drum at the beginning. We haven't looked and taken into account the fact that we may be destroying the natural world to make our instruments. So on we go. There we see the shakuhachi, which you can see is a beautiful bamboo pipe played by my friend Koji in Japan, but played in many parts of the world now. On we go. And there we see from that tradition, in fact, the comment, learning is an intellectual endeavor in the West, while in Japan, learning as it pertains to traditional arts is embodied. The body must learn first. From a Zen point of view, if the body learns first, the mind learns as well. If the mind learns first, there is no guarantee the body will. And I would say that that last sentence describes a lot of the way in which we've examined music in the West, that the mind has learned to decode the notes, but the body has not embraced them. It is why, of course, these classical traditions have valued playing from memory so highly. Because when we've memorized a piece, what we mean is that we have taken it into our own body. And that is why playing from memory is considered an important way of playing, because then the body and the mind are acting together. And the route for people in the literate traditions is a long one. In a sense, you have to be able to decode the notes, but then you have to be able to go beyond the notes so that they enter into your body in a very special way. On we go. The violin, just reminding you what it is, this is from Shakespeare. Now is the soul ravished. Is it not strange that sheep guts should hail souls out of men's bodies? Isn't that wonderful? That combination of wood and sheep guts can make those wonderful feelings. On we go. And there we see the notion of wonder that the baby has, and it has no fear of vocal sounds, but the range of sounds. And it is by these sounds that the mother and child interact in this improvised way. The baby knows how to improvise and be orate. Often the mother or the father has to relearn that to enter into that relationship. On we go. And the body, the whole body is expressive. It's going to school that we make the first false step. It is at school that he has learned the habit of stifling so thoroughly the natural companionship of body and mind. Unfortunately today, writes Rabindranath Tagore, in civilized community, expression through movement is repressed and is no longer looked upon as quite proper. We need to think deeply as to where we cannot make some new kind of compromise between our bodies and our minds. By repressing all activity of the body, so many school lessons remain absolutely dead and ineffective. And that will be true of many subjects other than music. So the notion of embodiment, and I've said that our vocal cords, all of our limbs are all in our sound. On we go.
And June, just a gentle reminder, it's quarter to.
Yep. On we go. But maybe the stones are singing. This is from an indigenous North American. Did you know trees talk where they do? They talk to each other and they'll talk to you if you listen. Trouble is white people don't listen. They never learn to listen to the Indians, so I don't suppose they'll listen to other voices in nature. They're becoming increasingly aware that actually the natural world is singing and that indigenous cultures knew that, but somehow or other we forgot that. So on we go. Stones are not closed, stones are open. It is a work of art. I am dance, now I am dance as the bones sings the stones. On we go. And we see with somebody like Bernie Krauser making sounds from the great animal orchestra, changing them electronically. And he makes three different sorts of sounds: geophony, the non-biological sound that occur wind in trees, water in streams; biophony, the collective sound made by all the species in a given habitat; and anthropophony, human generated sound. And now of course we have technophony as well. But the notion that we've ignored geophony and biophony, really, although we are finding more and more pieces now with natural sounds coming into them. On we go. I'm going to skip over these quite quickly. The mood of there, and there's the expression. We can express things in music that we can't express any other way. On we go. And there we see music. We see a child expressing joy, and on we go. And then the way things are put together, that the aurate pieces contain in general a much greater sense of much greater number of repetitions, and so on. And then we have value systems, the notion of using music to bring people together in some way or other, cooperation, reconciliation, and I would include not only between human beings, but between human beings and the natural world and the other than human world. On we go. And music and culture, we can create sound, create structures. So if we do choose to sing with the trees, we may be creating new alliances with the other than human world. On we go. And on we go. So we can create communitas. These are pictures from Space for Peace, which Doris mentioned. You have people of various cultures. You see the imam there with his candle. You see the children, you see the choirs. Some of them will be singing from printed scores, and some of them will be singing in an orate manner, bringing the two traditions together and not valuing one more highly than the other. On we go. And that may take us to the liminal experience, an experience which is a different way of knowing, and we may see as a magic way of knowing. And that experience is transformative. And if we can take people by understanding how music works to that experience, we can transform cultures and individual people within them. On we go. And there's this concept of spirituality. Francisca, would you go to a slide that's got postlude on it, which is right near the end somewhere. Skip through all of that, which is what we might do in schools, which I'm going to leave. There we see, you see exactly in that slide you've just seen, adult choirs singing, some of them from the music and some of them from the dots and some not. On we go. Keep going to the one called postlude. Keep going. That's it. Go back a little. That's it. Just go back to deintegration. No, further on. That's it. Everyone must be willing to allow one form of themselves to die, so that what they are really meant to be can come to life. Or as Lewis Carroll put it, there is no use going back to yesterday, for I was a different person then. So those of you who are classical musicians may need to look at your value systems again. Those of you who are folk musicians and are orate musicians, you may like to consider learning the dots and how the classical tradition works. And you may like to do, as I have done, create pieces where some people are reading the dots and some are not. Some people are improvising, children with profound and multiple difficulties using sounds to express themselves. Then I think we will have a value system which values everybody equally and includes also the natural world in our thinking about music. And move on then. And thank you for your attention. There are some of the books that I've written, Constructing Musical Healing, which was the first one, and then Experiencing Music and Spirituality, and so on. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to answering some of the questions.
June, thank you so much. I'm breathless. It's been such a fascinating journey that you have taken us on. I can see why it would be difficult for you to shorten your talk. So let's get some questions in. There are two in the Q&A, and I have also received some privately, because unfortunately, if you're on the panel, the Q&A button won't work. So either send them to me or write them in the chat. Michaela Arcas would like to know, I have a 3-month-year-old boy, and when he starts screaming, I feel a cutting sharp sound in my ears and have to pee really urgently. How should I understand this?
Quite often the problem for parents and children is that the sound that the child makes triggers some of our own traumatic experiences from our own childhood. And what you're trying to do, the peeing, of course, is trying, of course, peeing is another way of purifying oneself as well. So it's a way of releasing some of that energy. And one way of dealing with it is to understand that I can't remember whether it was a boy or a boy, I think.
A boy.
That he may have a better way of purifying himself, and a mother who is allowing that to happen more than your own mother did or your own parents did. So the peeing, I think, will be a way of releasing some of your own anxiety and shared trauma. We all have that from what's happened in our childhood. And often the scream of the child, because of the stress that we've had on motherhood. So every mother is supposed to know exactly why her child is doing it. Complete and utter rubbish, because what it's made is meant that all mothers think they've failed if they don't know why. And so the notion of child screaming triggers the mother's shame. And shame is a very, very traumatic emotion. So do have a pee, but also accept the fact he may be wiser than you in purifying himself and understand that that's what he may be doing. But best of all, take him in your arms and say it's all right. You don't need to be afraid. You don't need to be frightened. I will hold you. Mm. Or sing him that. Sing him, I will hold you tight. I will hold you tight. Mm. Just a very simple thing like that to counterbalance the screaming.
Thank you, June. And we have another question from Michael. Traumatized people on the AD spectrum often have particularly high or metallic voices. How could they use voice to work with becoming more embodied?
Well, whenever we have using just a single bit of our big range, one of the ways is the therapists work in this area would first of all take the sound that's being offered. Then, so if it's a high metallic sound, try and offer something a little bit lower, but start where they are and move down from it. The first thing to do with people is to accept the sound they're making and not to regard it as wrong. And that's where the finding your own note. Someone needs to say, that's okay, that's a good note, and so on. So repeat the sound, but also then try and, as you're following them, bring your sound down a bit and see if you can bring their sound down. So that instead of using just the top of their bodies, up here with the, where the metallic sound comes from, bringing it down so that in the end you can get it down to the bottom, ooh, ah, to the more rooted sound. But that top means that haven't got the rootedness with the earth. Might also be helpful if they can bear it to have no shoes on, and to make sure that the feet are tight on the ground, because it needs grounding and bringing down from the heart, the top, down into the ground in some way. So if you can have that, even to go outside onto the earth, and because the whole thing needs, and one of our problems at the West, as in ballet, that we value these high sounds, but we need to earth it all down. I find it fascinating that the West valued Allegri's Miserere with boys reaching a top C, whereas the Buddhist monks are seeing how low they can get to get close to the spiritual. Somehow or other, I have a sense if we could put both together, we might have a full range of spirituality rather than just one bit of it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, June. You're a fount of knowledge, and I hate to dismiss all the other questions, but I have to keep an eye on the time, or at least I'm being told to do that. I have learned so much.
Can I just say that music, spirituality, and when that music, the website is in the chat. And so if people want to carry on a conversation, they can carry it on there.
Thank you, Fran, my wonderful tech host, for putting all the relevant links in the chat. I have learned a lot about music and many new words, actually. It's fascinating. Musicking, rorting, oracy, cymatics, feeningful. These are treasures, really. And I loved your, I could pick out many things, but bringing us to this liminal experience that you mentioned towards the end, I think that's what happened here. It's such a rich talk. And I'm sure we could all stay and listen for another hour at least. And our time is up, and I'm left to not only thank you, but also invite the audience to, if you'd like to continue the discussion with other participants, join the coffee break, which can be accessed through the portal, join our Facebook groups. Thanks again for Mark Walsh and the team for hosting everyone here. And a reminder that, of course, you can watch this and many other talks for another 48 hours. But if you'd like to digest it at your own time, or if you just, the winter's coming up, long evenings, and you just want to keep learning and feeding your intellect, although we've learned today, we should probably get outside more and scream a bit more. But still, buy the library. It's on special offer. And if you buy it today, there are loads of goodies, free bonuses, workshops, ebooks, webinars, the entire 2018 tech conference. So make use of that. And Fran, is she there still? No, sorry. Where's June? She's still there?
She's out.
Oh, no. Okay, then we'll have to find out. We won't find out her top embodiment tip. I would say sing, scream, scream from the bottom of your body to the top of it, and a scream a day keeps the doctor away. I wish you all a wonderful evening, day, or wherever you are in the world, whatever time it is. And it was a great honor to have you all here and listen to this wise woman.